supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney is tapping a professor and seasoned educator to join the School Reform Commission. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports that at least one group still wants to see the agency abolished.
Mayor Jim Kenney says he chose Temple University professor Christopher McGinley because he will bring a wealth of educational experience to the state commission that oversees Philadelphia public schools. At Temple, McGinley's training the next generation of principals and administrators and thinks he will help the SRC.
I think that I can bring 35 years of experience in public education as a teacher, as a principal, and as a superintendent. And I can also bring a commitment to doing right by students. And that's been my track record wherever I've worked.
McGinley wants to improve neighborhood high schools and coordinate efforts between schools and other service agencies.
I think that the mayor's secretary of education and the mayor share those concerns, and that's part of the momentum behind the community schools movement.
McGinley says he's worried the district is not attracting quality teachers because the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers and the district don't have a contract.
I think that a priority needs to be reaching an agreement with the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers.
Jerry Jordan, the head of that union, praises McGinley, but still believes the SRC should be abolished.
They've not been successful. And they were appointed by the governor in 2001. And it's time for them to leave.
McGinley currently serves as coordinator for the Educational Leadership Program at Temple. From 2008 to 2014, he served as superintendent of schools in the Lower Merion School District. He's also the former executive director of the Delaware County Intermediate Unit and former superintendent in Cheltenham Township. McGinley says he's not leaving Temple University, but will bring his experience to the new unpaid post. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
The New Jersey Supreme Court made a decision today that echoed through the state's housing sector. It said the towns were responsible for affordable housing obligations, even when the state wasn't assigning those obligations. WHYY New Jersey reporter Joe Hernandez has been following the case and joins me now. Joe, first off, bring us up to speed.
Right. So the fight over affordable housing in New Jersey goes back almost half a century to a couple court cases in the 70s and 80s. And they said that every city and town in New Jersey has to zone for its fair share of affordable housing. The idea here was to stop towns from excluding people who wanted to live there but maybe couldn't afford it. And in a state with as high a cost of living as New Jersey, that was pretty important.
Did it work out?
For a while it worked out, but in 1999, the wheels started to come off a little bit. There was this state agency called the Council on Affordable Housing, and this was the agency that was supposed to say to each town, okay, you're responsible for zoning this much affordable housing. That's your fair share. But between 1999 and 2015, the Council on Affordable Housing was just not functioning, so some towns stopped zoning for affordable housing altogether.
And that brings us to the case just decided by the state Supreme Court.
Right. A group of cities and towns was fighting to remove this 16-year gap period from their affordable housing obligations going forward. They basically said, look, the state failed to assign us affordable housing obligations during those years, so we shouldn't be held accountable. But housing advocates said that the cities and towns knew full well that they had this constitutional obligation to zone for affordable housing, and so they should be held responsible if they didn't do it. Today, the Supreme Court agreed with that reasoning. They said cities and towns will have to take into account, going forward, people from that period who needed housing between 1999 and 2015 and who still need it now. Kevin Walsh runs the nonprofit Fair Share Housing Center, a housing advocacy group, and he praised the ruling.
This is a victory for lower-income households and people with disabilities. The court rejected the municipality's attempts to exclude lower-income households based on when they came into existence.
Now, Joe, to be clear, what do towns have to consider when calculating their affordable housing obligations for the next 10 years?
Well, they have to consider two categories that they've always had to consider: current substandard housing and future expected affordable housing needs. But the Supreme Court said today, add one more category to that mix, people who needed affordable housing between 1999 and 2015, who didn't get it and who still need it now. Those people shouldn't be excluded.
And with that, how many additional affordable homes are we considering?
Well, Dave, that is going to be the question going forward. The Fair Share Housing Center says the gap period ruling could create as much as 100,000 new homes, but people representing the towns obviously put that number much lower. Mike Serra works at the New Jersey State League of Municipalities. He told me not only do they not know how many homes this is going to create, but they don't even know how to calculate those people who needed housing back then and who still need it now.
It's sort of like the end of a movie where there's a plot twist that guarantees a sequel. It's very likely that, you know, we might be before this very same court on this very same issue in the not-too-distant future.
So there may be a lot more to this debate going forward.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks.
WHYY New Jersey correspondent Joe Hernandez on Newsworks Tonight. Law enforcement agencies in the Philadelphia area are stepping up efforts to crack down on human trafficking. Details from WHYY's Katie Colinari.
Last year, at least 116 cases of human trafficking were reported in Pennsylvania, while New Jersey logged 143. That's according to the National Human Trafficking Hotline. But Philadelphia Police Commissioner Richard Ross says it's not clear just how widespread the problem is in this region.
I will be candid with you that in local law enforcement, this is something that has flown beneath the radar, and that is the issue, and I think nationally.
City police are now part of a new task force that's taking a more proactive approach. The group includes U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Homeland Security, and the FBI. Jim Carpenter is head of the Philadelphia District Attorney's Family Violence and Sexual Assault Unit. He says authorities stumble upon human trafficking cases by accident while investigating other crimes. And often, victims are too afraid to come forward because they're worried that they're the ones who've broken the law.
If I am a woman who is being forced to engage in sex with other men and being beaten and having a gun pointed at me on a regular basis, am I going to go to the police? Well, no, I'm going to get arrested. And then I'm going to get beaten by my trafficker.
Now, members of the task force say they're working together to build cases against a growing database of known traffickers. They're also working closely with nonprofits. Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Banfield is with the Salvation Army, which has been helping victims of traffickers in the region for years.
But we see that it is a larger problem than just what the Salvation Army can handle. And there's more ramifications to this than just our bringing them into a safe place and getting them to feel warm, clean, et cetera, et cetera.
Banfield says getting victims to trust law enforcement will be key to putting more traffickers behind bars. Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
Many will be traveling to Washington, D.C. to either celebrate or protest Friday's inauguration of Donald Trump as the nation's 45th president. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports on how some are marking the occasion in Philadelphia.
For the first time ever, the Free Library of Philadelphia will host a live viewing party of a presidential inauguration. It's billed as a civic engagement fair, and it will feature both Democratic and Republican Party representatives, as well as organizations that have been directly or indirectly targeted by the incoming Trump administration, namely Planned Parenthood and Reforma, a Spanish-language library support group. The African American Museum in Philadelphia will host an event on the eve of the inauguration, a goodbye party for President Barack Obama.
If we run
along the streets of Philadelphia, about 30 large banners made by as many artists will hang from business fronts. These signs of solidarity are going up in neighborhoods from South Philly to Old City to Germantown. A co-coordinator of this effort is Eric Prizendance, and he says these signs are meant to foster a sense of tolerance and hope rather than point criticisms directly at Donald Trump.
We're going to see over the next 2 weeks or so, you'll see opportunities for people to more strongly assert their political positions. But I think with this project, we really wanted to make sure that it was about love and inclusivity and solidarity instead of anger and divisiveness.
Other reactions to the inauguration are more barbed. Musician Raj Haldar, better known as Lush Life, began writing and producing new material immediately after the election. In less than 10 weeks, he produced an album with about a dozen collaborators. It's called Idols and Enemies. Gang, gang. And that's the told to so monopolizing. Where I flows in the fog grows. Idols and Enemies is a dark album full of despair about neighborhood gentrification, government corruption, and global tension. Lush Life drove himself to exhaustion to make sure this album would be ready for the inauguration, but he says the highly charged political album does not target Trump specifically.
It felt to me like it would be a disservice to point everything at Donald Trump when, like, Donald Trump is an endgame of a lot of problematic, broader issues.
The album is available as a Pay What You Wish download. Lush Life is suggesting $8, all of which will be donated to the ACLU. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Pennsylvania was one of the states that unexpectedly swung Republican in November. With the inauguration just around the corner, Keystone Crossroads is launching a series called I Voted Trump, checking in with a few Trump supporters throughout the presidency. Eleanor Klibanoff introduces us to 8 voters from around the state.
Matt Pacifico isn't typical mayor material. He's young and hip, wears an earring, and has a stormtrooper helmet behind his desk. When Pacifico first ran for mayor of Altoona 4 years ago, he'd never held elected office, though he did have experience running a successful family business. Trump's campaign asked Pacifico to speak at the August rally Trump held in Altoona.
Yeah, it was probably one of the coolest experiences ever. You know, I mean, I was so nervous to speak in front of that many people. And when I came out and, you know, said something in my opening line.
I am honored to have the opportunity to speak on the same stage as Mr. Donald J. Trump, our next president of the United States.
And the crowd started to, you know, get into it. And then, like, all the nerves just went away.
Pacifico sees his vote from two perspectives, as a citizen and as a mayor responsible for one of Pennsylvania's many distressed cities. He says the biggest issue for Altoona voters is bringing back jobs. So that's the biggest issue for him as well.
They're all very hopeful that Trump will be able to follow through on what he said about bringing jobs back into the communities where, you know, the industries were here at one time and then, you know, left.
Communities like Shamokin in what used to be Pennsylvania coal country. Today, it's a rundown little town with 7,000 residents, a quarter of whom live under the federal poverty line.
Okay, come on out. Let them know.
Jim Bowers runs God's Chuck Wagon, a mobile soup kitchen in Shamokin and the surrounding towns. He voted for Trump for the same reason Pacifico did.
I just want jobs. I just want to be able to look out there and say, these people I don't need to feed no more. These people can make it on their own.
God's Chuck Wagon served over 22,000 people in 2015, according to their website, and Bowers says that number is always growing. He wants a president who cares about coal country, and he thinks that'll be Donald Trump. A little further north in Schuylkill County, Jessica Turpak agrees.
Me and my husband have a small oil company called Turpak Oil.
The past 8 years have been hard for these small business owners.
Obamacare, to me, is my number one priority. Getting rid of it. Obamacare, if it continues in this household and something happens, we could really lose everything we worked for.
She's hopeful that Trump will repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. But beyond politics, Turpak also just likes Trump. She dressed her toddler, Hunter, to look like the candidate, and Trump brought him on stage during a rally in Wilkes-Barre. She says she gets him.
I tend to say what I think. I can relate to him in that aspect. That he says what he thinks.
Plain talk also appealed to Seth Coffer, a gastroenterologist and Republican ward leader in Philadelphia.
The fact that we had an outsider who is speaking plain English at a level where all voters can understand, all that excitement is exactly what our party needed.
Coffer is gay and lives in bright blue Philadelphia, but he served as a Trump delegate at the Republican National Convention. He felt Trump was unfairly depicted as divisive during the election.
That is not the message that I hear from Mr. Trump, and that's not what I feel among the delegates from all over the country. I heard them standing, applauding, cheering for inclusive policies.
Coffer's fellow ward leader, Daphne Goggins, says as a black woman, she had no issue with voting for Donald Trump.
I've never seen anything less racist than the Republican Party. Yeah, a lot of them are white, but some of them are black also. We are a big tent party.
Goggins is a community activist and recovering drug addict. She's a mother, a grandmother, and a lifelong Republican. Goggins campaigned for Trump because she thinks he's the country's best chance to defeat ISIS, stop illegal immigration, and bring back jobs. If Trump is successful, Goggins thinks he could be the catalyst to bring more black voters from inner-city Philadelphia over to the Republican Party. Trump had an easier sell in central Pennsylvania, where many counties have voted Republican for decades. In Altoona on election night, Ben Hornberger, a 23-year-old former Marine, was ready to let loose and celebrate the victory.
It's been a long, long stretch. I've been working since April with the campaign. I've been doing this for a long time, and it's so good right now.
Hornberger campaigned for Obama in 2012, but by 2016, he was one of the Trump campaign's most committed volunteers. He took time off from work to attend rallies around the state and put in long hours at campaign headquarters. But by Christmas, the election night high had tempered.
I don't expect him to be able to fulfill all of his campaign promises in 4 years. 4 years is not a long time with Congress and Senate.
Hornberger works at a DSL call center, making $20,000 a year. He's hoping to go to college so he can one day follow in the footsteps of Trump and run for office himself. Pittsburgh resident Penny Stenger also voted for Obama in 2012, but backed Bernie Sanders during the primary. When he lost, she turned to Trump.
I thought, Lord, what am I doing here? Why am I voting for Mr. Trump? And I thought, oh, right to life. It really is about that. He will have a chance to nominate and put in three or four judges, and it will overturn what should be overturned.
But by early January, things had changed.
You know, I talked about voting for him because of pro-life. And then I realized after the election, he's not pro-life. If I were to do it again, it would be Hillary. It would have to be.
Up north in Erie County, Trump voters Phil and Marianne Spots slowly came around to Donald Trump during the primaries. But now they're all in, so much so that they're taking a bus to D.C. for the inauguration and bringing their granddaughter with them.
I think it'll be a good experience for Allie that she'll remember this the rest of her life. And we've never experienced the inauguration.
17-year-old Allie Skinner couldn't vote, but was a Trump supporter and stayed up until 4 a.m. watching election returns.
It would just mean the world to me to get to go and support Trump as the peaceful transfer of power comes, just to be a part of the American system and see that this is how our government works, and it's really, truly amazing.
This week, Donald Trump will be sworn into office, and the 3 million Pennsylvanians who helped put him there, including a stormtrooper mayor, a mobile soup kitchen operator, a Philly ward leader, an ex-Marine, and a Bernie Sanders supporter with cold feet, will be watching to see what comes next. Eleanor Klibanoff, Keystone Crossroads.
This was the first in an occasional Keystone Crossroads series. I voted Trump, checking with Trump supporters throughout his presidency. Keystone Crossroads reporters Emily Previty, Margaret Krause, Jessica Korkunas, and Lindsay Lazarski contributed reporting. Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY is the lead station. Finally this evening, Temple University has announced it will rename its School of Media and Communications to honor Philadelphia broadcast pioneer Lou Klein. The Lou Klein College of Media and Communication will be formally dedicated this spring, part of events marking the school's 50th anniversary celebration. The university says the renaming is a tribute to Klein's more than six decades of teaching at the school. Klein started teaching at Temple in 1952 while working as an executive producer for American Bandstand, launching the career of host Dick Clark. From 1952 until 1964, Bandstand was broadcast live from WPVI's studio at 46th and Market Streets. When the show moved to Hollywood, the West Philly studio then became the home of WHYY. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Before the next administration takes over, activists are archiving federal data on climate change. WHYY's Susan Phillips will show us what that's like. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.